Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have here back on the program once again Ken Cuno. He's professor of history at the University of Illinois. He's interested in the history of the modern Middle East. And on this program, for a number of occasions, he's been here to talk about politics in Egypt. Just last week, people in Egypt went to the polls to cast votes in the country's first free presidential elections. There were 13 candidates competing in the first round. Two of them will now be contending in a runoff scheduled for next month. One is a candidate who is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. The other served as the prime minister under the old regime of Hosni Mubarak. So we'll try to talk a little bit about the recent elections and what likely is ahead for the country. And as always, questions are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. If you would like to send your question by email, you may do that as well. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, you can give us a call. Well, thank you once again for
being
here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Maybe it would be worth talking a little bit first just about how significant it is that these elections took place at all.
Well, I think it's huge. This is a country that hasn't had free elections in over 60 years, since 1950 was the last one, and that was under the last election under the old monarchy that was overthrown in 1952 by the free officers led by Nasser. And under the monarchy, only some of the elections were free and fair. About maybe half or more than half were rigged by the monarchy itself. And the franchise, of course, wasn't universal. Women didn't vote back then and so forth and so on. So this is major, and it reverses, it potentially, if it sticks, you know, it reverses a long-term trend from the middle of the 20th century forward. Now, Tunisia has also had, so far it seems, a successful transition toward democracy post-dictatorship, but Egypt carries a lot more weight. It's the largest Arab country with 85 million or so people. It's cultural center. It's been a political leader in the past, and so if they continue to have free elections that have a high degree of legitimacy in the sense that they're perceived as fair, as this one has been, if they continue to have peaceful elections and transfers of power, that could have a strong influence on the region, and very positive one, in my opinion.
Now, it's my understanding that fewer than half of the eligible voters voted. So the turnout was like 46%.
That's right. That's right.
Why were there so many people that apparently just said they didn't want to participate?
Well, nobody knows. I mean, that remains to be analyzed. The first post-revolutionary vote, you'll recall, was in March of 2011 to approve the provisional constitution, and it passed. The turnout was around 77% of eligible voters. In the parliamentary elections held in three stages between November and January of the past year, the turnout was still above 50%. I can't remember the exact figures, but 55 or 54%, comparable to U.S. presidential elections. So declining to 46 has some meaning, but I don't know what it is. And I haven't yet seen any kind of analysis, expert or otherwise, as to why that declined. Now, you do have to go to your home district to vote. People overseas, Egyptians overseas, were able to vote absentee. But for example, an Egyptian, say, whose home is Alexandria, but who was working, say, in Cairo and couldn't get back, apparently couldn't vote. I don't know how many people were caught in that situation. I don't know if there was a decline of interest. There shouldn't have been, because there seemed to be a lot of buzz, and there was a wide variety of candidates. Every candidate, 15 candidates, one for every point of view. It's occurred to me that there may be a glitch in the counting. In other words, in terms of the number of the estimate of eligible voters may be overestimated. I just don't know. I have no idea what that means.
But it would not have been that people thought it didn't matter.
I can't imagine that. I can't imagine that, because if you're a pro-Islamist, pro-Muslim Brotherhood, then you would want to vote for Morsi to nail down control. If you were freaked out by the Islamists controlling parliament, then you'd want to vote for one of the other people. And in fact, a slim majority of people did vote for the non-Islamist candidates.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that's interesting, I think, to me, at least if I'm understanding it right. So we're going to have this runoff involving the two candidates that got to the most votes, the
yes.
top two. That would be Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood and Ahmed Shafiq, who was a former prime minister. And so there'll be a runoff between the two of them. At the same time, it seems that then there was the guy who came in third also was an Islamist candidate. And then if you look
Sabahi was a non-religious, as they call them, non-Islamist. Yeah. Sabahi was the leftist socialist or Nasserite, as he called himself, who was anti-Shafiq because Shafiq was identified with the old regime, and anti-Morsi because Morsi is tied to the Muslim Brotherhood. So he was the one, Sabahi was the one who surged late and was seemingly the favorite candidate of the so-called revolutionaries, which is the catch-all term for the non-religious supporters of the revolution.
So that, I guess, what I was thinking of, it seemed that those people who had not been wanted to vote for Muslim Brotherhood, would not wanted to vote for anybody who had a connection with the old regime,
mm-hmm.
that they split their votes
yes.
among various candidates. And if those people had actually managed to line up behind somebody, one person, then that person would have won.
Yes. That's the nature of politics. There tends to be splitting. It tends to be sectarian, especially on the left. For people who want to get a handle on this, if you're familiar with the French system, and they just had a presidential election recently, the Egyptian political system is more or less modeled on the French in the sense that you've got a strong executive president who wields power, but you also have a prime minister who also is involved in running the government. So it's been called a semi-presidential system. But the election for president are similar as well, that you can have multiple candidates who qualify, as was the case in the recent French elections. And so it was Sarkozy and Hollande, the socialist. Okay. But if you put Sarkozy along with the one further to the right, I forget her name now, Le Pen, Marine Le Pen. So the right wing actually got right and center right got a larger vote in the French first round, but in the second round, Sarkozy, the more rightist candidate, lost to Hollande. So, in other words, so this kind of splitting happens, but that's the way the system works. Whereas in the American system, I don't know if there's a threshold, but we have had presidents elected in three-way races, like Nixon in 68 or Clinton in 92, who got less than 50% of the vote, but got a plurality, and then the Electoral yeah. College put them over the top. So we don't have this runoff. But that's the way it was.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So maybe just one. We can talk some more about Morsi and Shafiq and who these men are. But it seems that really the big question is, for those people who do identify with the revolutionaries who did not vote for either of those two people. So now we're going to have a runoff. Who are they going to vote for?
That's the big question. Perhaps none of the above. There's been no polling or no polls published so far since the runoff. It looks like a rather volatile situation. Both of the candidates now are, and this is in anticipation ahead of the final vote. The runoff vote is going to be June 16th, 17th. Okay, so there's a ways to go, at least 2 to 3 weeks, 2 weeks, I guess. Morsi, it was a little bit like, might be comparable to the American primaries versus the general election. In other words, the first round, because Morsi was running to the right to try to attract the voters who had supported the Noor party candidate who was disqualified. Now, the Noor party, N-O-U-R, which means light, is the party of the extreme Islamists, the so-called Salafis, who are put much more emphasis on social issues like veiling and enforced prayer and banning alcohol than does the Muslim Brotherhood. They make the Muslim Brotherhood look moderate, quote unquote. But their candidate was disqualified, and so Morsi was running to the right to try to garner that support and emphasizing more the social issues and saying he would they would implement Sharia, which is an extremely vague formula because there's many Sharias and it can mean different things to different people. So it gives him a lot of wiggle room, but it still would be upsetting to the non-religious people, people we call secularists, but secularism is a bad word in Arabic, so they call themselves civil society supporters. We call them non-religious. So now having run to the right and gotten 24 point something of the vote and barely come in first, and now he's running more toward the center. He's trying to rally the non-religious anti-regime people by saying, oh, this guy Ahmed Shafiq, he's Mubarak's man, he's going to bring back the old regime. And so let's all of us anti-Mubarak people stand together. He's trimming, attacking that way. Mm-hmm. Now, Shafiq, of course, is doing exactly the opposite. He ran as the law and order candidate. Look at what these revolutionaries have done. There's a huge crime wave. The economy is going, you know, down the tubes. And I'm going to bring back law and order and make things right. And he's also, you know, pledged himself to support the kind of neoliberal policies that Mubarak had been pursuing, and of course he ran as the anti-Islamist candidate, so now he's distancing himself a bit from the military, who actually is closely tied to, and he's saying, okay, everybody who's afraid of the Islamists, rally to my side, and never mind my connections with the old regime. We're going to be democratic. We're big tent. Blah blah blah. So they're all running toward the center. They're both running toward the center now, but it's so far the leaders of the non-Islamist, non-regime connected parties, old regime connected parties, have most of them have held off endorsing either candidate, and it's just not sure where that plurality will go. And again, they might just sit out the vote. My guess would be that many people would just sit it out.
All right. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Ken Cuno. He's Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois. Has been here on the program before to talk about politics in Egypt, and that's what we're doing, talking a little bit about the recent election and what's likely to happen here in the weeks ahead. The number in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here to start us off in Champaign County. And this is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I have basically 2 points. The first is that I'd like for you to mention the fact that there was a law passed that would disallow anybody who held power in the prior regime to run. There's very little coverage of this. What I heard, it was characterized as something that the Islamicist parliament has wanted, whereas I think clearly, it is. There are a lot of secular people that would want to disqualify anybody with tinges of Mubarak, but the Electoral Commission disallowed it, saying that it was passed after he had filed his papers or something like that. And there's no constitution that has ex post facto in it, so it's basically. Apparently, the Electoral Commission also includes as the head of the Supreme Court, where it's being appealed to, so it doesn't look like the prospects are good to turn the page on Mubarak, and we have this position of picking the totalitarian remnant or the evil Islamicists. So a caricature of democracy, it seems to me. The third place candidate would then be elevated, and he's perhaps the U.S.'s worst nightmare in a lot of other countries as well. I would advocate him, obviously, but it doesn't look like he's going to have a chance to run. He was criticized as being the most anti-Israeli, whereas the sentiment on the street, it's been said that this was an internally driven election, and it was curious how Israel didn't come up, but I think it's a lack of reporting. There was a big campaign or a big rallying cry on Safir, on the square, Tahrir Square, that the gas deal that Mubarak did in 2005 or 6 or something that sells Israel and Jordan, I don't know what the terms are exactly identical, but for what was then 40% of the world price of natural gas, while middle-class Egyptians have to pick up their can of butane if they want to cook. So there was a lot of outrage on this. Mubarak's son, Gamal, was Mr. 5% on that deal and got a rake off on it. It's been abrogated, I guess, about a month ago, though I guess there's still some gas in the pipeline until they actually cut it off. And it seems to me that the fact that these kind of things are very rarely, both of these things are very rarely discussed. And like I say, when I did hear about the former issue of disallowing Mubarak cronies to run, it's cast as, this was NPR's casting mm-hmm. as a project. So anyway, those are my
Well, points. I think that, yeah, the caller is very well informed. And the only point I would disagree, I mean, simply was making a number of accurate points. And the one thing I would disagree with is that they have been discussed. I mean, these haven't been swept under the rug. The reason he knows about them and we know about them is that it has been discussed extensively in the press, both there and here. And one of the reasons it's easier to follow politics over there now than, say, it was 15 years ago, is that many of the news outlets, the newspapers, including new independent ones, have English online editions. And this is where one can keep up with this stuff. But the caller was quite right that Shafiq was there was a law that was passed by the Muslim Brotherhood dominated parliament. The Muslim Brotherhood's party is the Freedom and Justice Party, FJP. So it was an FJP dominated parliament that passed this law banning any candidate from running who had ties to the old regime or had served the old regime. And that certainly would have included Shafiq, who was in the cabinet, Mubarak's cabinet, for a long time as the Minister of Civil Aviation, and then was appointed Prime Minister, I think it was 3 days after the beginning of the January 25 revolution. But this law was not approved by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which sort of holds the executive position, so it would have to ratify that. And so the Presidential Election Commission, whose decisions are not subject to appeal legally, basically said, no, he can run, so reinstated Shafiq. So that's how he – so according to the rules – and again, the rules, we can say the rules are stupid or unfair, just like many of the rules in our own elections are stupid and unfair, but – in a sense, if nobody plays by the – if we can't amend the rules as we go along. I mean, that's the argument that would be made over there. So Shafiq is in. Sabahi, yes, finished a very strong third with about one-fifth of the entire vote. So just a few points below Shafiq and Morsi. And he – yeah, I think he was described today in the press as having been sort of the most anti-Israel in his statements. But, you know, criticizing Israel in Egyptian politics is a little bit like supporting Israel in American politics. You can't go wrong. It's kind of a given. It's a default position. So it wasn't an issue. Israel wasn't an issue in the election in the sense that there was no disagreement on Israel, or a little bit like maybe ethanol in the Midwest. And the gas deal was canceled months ago, so that wasn't an issue in the election either.
One of the questions that I definitely wanted to have you talk about was just how much power – well, we know how much power the ruling council and military council has now. Essentially, they're the government. The question is once – and they have – I think they at some point promised that they would turn over – control of the government to this new elected civilian government sometime next month, presumably after we get through with this next round of the election and then there's a precedent. But there are questions about just how much power this newly elected president is going to have. Mm-hmm. And I think some people wonder, well, is the military council really still going to be the power in the government? And will it matter very much who is elected the next president?
Well, I think it does matter who's elected, because the government will have real authority and the president will have real power unless something really unexpected happens. The SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, have promised to turn over power to whoever is elected president by the end of June. So that's going to be less than 2 weeks after the election, after the balloting, and it'll take a few days for official results to be confirmed. They've been sticking to that. I mean, the deadline has moved around since last year at this time, but they've pretty much carried through so far on their undertaking, and it seems to me that they're pretty serious about doing that. I mean, there would be a huge explosion if they didn't. They simply could not seize power in a military coup of some sort for two reasons. I mean, one is that they're dependent on American aid, and the Americans, presumably behind the scenes, are making pretty clear that they want the generals to leave power and let the process run its course. And the other thing is that whatever these crusty old generals think, I mean, the army is a conscript army. And the reason that they told Mubarak to leave a year and a half ago is that they realized that the rank-and-file soldiers will not fire on their fellow unarmed countrymen who are demonstrating in favor of what the soldiers themselves want, you know, a democratic mm-hmm. Egypt with a better conditions of living. So that's really not an option for them to hang on to direct power. What they will do is they've said, in addition to handing over power in at the end of June, that they do intend to issue another constitutional statement, which will amend the interim constitution that's in place right now, that was approved in March 2011. It's not clear when they're going to issue that. It's also not clear what exactly that statement will be. It'll amount to some kind of amendment. But the assumption is that they will try to, protect their privileged position in the political system as it is. This is the so-called deep state that the military has. They have a number of factories. They started off producing, things like ammunition, things related to the military, but now they produce a lot of civilian durable goods. They've got construction companies and so on. Some estimates are that the military control about 40% of GDP in the country. So there's a kind of a mini empire or a state within a state there. They've also, the SCAF have in the past talked about making the military budget not subject to review. If it's not subject to review, I don't know who can approve it. And also maybe having a say in, of course, they will have an informal say in who's appointed Minister of Defense and so forth and so on. So in these various respects, and also not to be, it's pretty clear that they don't expect to have any charges brought against members of the military or the SCAF for things that have happened in the past. For example, the massacre of demonstrators at Maspero last year. In August, I think it was, mm-hmm. or September. So of course, I think if Shafiq is elected, of course, he's the military's man. He comes from the old regime, and he will have pretty cordial relations with the generals. But public opinion, and especially the parliament, may push him to be a little bit independent of the military. If Morsi is elected, we could expect a bit more friction. Or perhaps quite a bit of friction with the military. But they probably will continue to be quite influential because, I mean, they've got the weaponry and the guns, mm-hmm. and they could also sort of rally the people who are worried about the Islamists. On the other hand, in addition to capitalizing on the public's disinclination to see a return to military rule or dictatorship of some sort, Morsi could also sort of play on the constitutional issue. In other words, that he is the civilian head of government and the military should be subordinate. So mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a government versus military tension down the line, no matter what. It's going to take a time for play out, but hopefully this democratic process, which has had a promising beginning with these three elections, will continue.
Well, here's, of course, the inevitable what do you think will happen question, which is, I know, very difficult to answer. But in the first round, Mursi and Shafiq came pretty close in the number of votes that they received. Mm-hmm. So then the question is, of those people now who decide they can manage to vote for one or the other of them and will actually vote in the runoff, what do you think that it's more likely that people will either vote for change, and I suppose that would mean that they would vote for Mursi, or they would take what would be the safer choice, at least it would be more of the same, and vote for Shafiq? I mean, for people who say, all right, I really do want to vote, how do you think that they go about making a choice like that?
Well, I'm not sure who would represent the safer choice, because if you distrust the Morsi and the Islamists, if you think that, well, you know, as soon as he gets into power, then it's going to turn into Saudi Arabia, then he's not a safe choice. Mm-hmm. But if you distrust Shafiq in the military, I mean, if you think that, well, what Shafiq is going to do is simply bring back Mubarak, Mubarak Light, in a new form, then that's not really a safe choice either if you're opposed to the neoliberal policies, anti-labor policies, for example, and the anti-democratic, the hardline, because he's also talked about, you know, well, he said on the campaign trail, well, if they demonstrate while I'm president, you know, I'll clear the Tahrir Square in one day. That'll be that, you know, and the police will go back to their jobs and so forth and so on. So if you like democracy, he's not necessarily a palatable choice either. Now, of course, we don't know what these fellows will do once they're in power and confronted with the realities of power. One possibly safe choice would be to go for a divided government. If the parliament is dominated by Islamists, well, then you want Shafiq as president. That's one way. But another way of looking at divided government is this military versus civilian government thing. Perhaps you might say, well, we need a strong non-military, albeit Islamist, civilian government to stand to balance off the military. Mm-hmm. Again, I suspect that a lot of people who aren't in the base of either of these two candidates will sit it out. The supporters of Sabahi will tend to sit it out. And that perhaps it may be a matter of who can organize the base and get that smidgen of the rest who actually will vote. It's just very hard to predict how that election will go.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this morning with Ken Cuno. He's professor of history at University of Illinois. We're talking about Egypt. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Donated blood saves the lives of the injured and critically ill. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is on the web at bloodservices.org.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. We're here Monday through Friday, 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we will talk with Roger Thoreau. He's a journalist. He's currently senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. For a long time, he was a reporter doing international coverage for the Wall Street Journal and has written a lot about the issue of hunger. And we'll be talking about his most recent book. The title is The Last Hunger Season, which takes a look at a farm community in Kenya, working with a non-governmental organization that has been very helpful in helping those people be more productive. And one of the things that Roger Thoreau writes about is the fact that it doesn't seem to make sense, but if you look at the most chronically hungry people around the world, an awful lot of them are farmers. And the idea is, how is it they can be made more productive? We'll talk more about that in the second hour. Tomorrow, practical sort of a thing. In the 10 o'clock hour, Phil Nixon will be here. He's an extension specialist in entomology. And so if you have some bug problems, we can help with that. And then Tomorrow on the 11 o'clock hour, you'll be hearing an interview that I recorded a couple weeks ago with Cokie Roberts, a longtime NPR correspondent. She also works for ABC News. She was on the campus to speak at the commencement and sat down with me, and we talked about her family and her career, and we talked about women in American politics, something she's very interested in, so you can hear all of that tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. You can find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. In this hour of focus, we're talking about Egyptian politics with Ken Cuno. He's a professor of history here at the University of Illinois. If you have a question, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, just at the break point here, we were talking and didn't really get a chance to talk because I had to go back on here about the vote totals and how they broke down among some of the candidates who came out at the top. And depending upon, geographically speaking, where their support was, you see something interesting if you look at the various places where certain candidates are strong?
Egypt is a big country. Geographically, it's well known amongst, people familiar with Egypt that there are differences between large urban areas and the rural areas. As you would expect, the urban area is a bit more cosmopolitan than, say, liberal. Rural areas more conservative. And also there's a long-standing historical and cultural difference between Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. And Upper Egypt is upriver, meaning it's south of Cairo. Lower Egypt is the delta. Where most of the population are, by the way, about two-thirds of the population. So what we find here is very interesting that Sabahi, the third-place candidate, the one favored by the liberal so-called supporters of the revolutionaries, did well in Cairo. He came in first in Cairo, and he came in first in Alexandria. These are the two largest cities and most cosmopolitan cities. Alexandria is interesting because Alexandria had been described up until that point as a so-called bastion of Islamism. The Muslim Brotherhood was supposed to be, and the Salafis were supposed to be very strong there. Maybe they're very active, but he still took it by a whopping margin. Morsi came in second in Alexandria. So he swept Port Said as well, the northern city on the canal zone. So he did well. Sabahi did well in the urban areas, as one would expect. Now, in the rest of the country, Shafiq, the second place candidate, the one who is tied to the old Mubarak regime, did well in the delta. He won most, not all, but most of the lower Egyptian provinces, whereas Morsi won most of Upper Egypt. Now, this is kind of what you would expect because Upper Egypt you expect to be more religiously conservative. One of the interesting things is that the day after the vote, in which at a time in which informal results were already being reported, and it looked like Morsi and Shafiq were winning, a number of lay Coptic Christian leaders took credit for organizing a Christian vote for Shafiq. They said that they proceeded on the logic that the Christians had to concentrate their votes on one of the non-Islamic candidates, and so they encouraged Copts to vote for Shafiq. And this is connected with now, since then, some accusations by liberal revolutionaries that, you know, the Christians betrayed them by voting for Shafiq instead of Sabahi. In actuality, we don't know how the Christians voted. There are no reliable exit polls. The pattern of the vote is interesting because Shafiq won, and again, the reason he got into second place is because he won these very large delta provinces that have a very, very low Christian population. Outside of Cairo and Alexandria, which went to Sabahi, the two provinces with the largest Christian proportion of population are Minya and Asyut in Upper Egypt. And I think Shafiq did come in second in those provinces, but they were taken by Morsi. So it's not clear at all how the Christian vote went and whether it went in large numbers to Shafiq or not. But that's one of the day after kind of kvetching that's been going on, although it's been countered by other Christian spokesmen.
You know, I know we've talked about this a little bit already, but I guess I'm still thinking about those people who were really had great hopes that things would change and who were really unhappy with the results of the election because they because now in this runoff again, they're looking at either the man who is associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, which for a long time was really the biggest opposition force. And then you have this man who is a former military man, was, I think, at one time chief of the Air Force and then was the country's civil aviation minister and just right at the very end became prime minister. Right. So he's tainted by his association with the Mubarak regime. And I think a lot of people just sort of threw up their hands and said, well, this is like, what change has there been here? It's just same old, same old. So, I mean, going forward, even if those people decide, all right, this runoff, there's nothing for us here, we're just not going to vote. I mean, where do those people now take whatever political energy they have?
Well, and this is being talked about in that third group, is organizing, building for the future. That's where I would suggest that they put their energies if they're serious about building an alternative. I mean, one way of looking at the results is to say that, well, you know, this in a sense reflects the array of political forces in the country before the revolution. It's not the case that the regime was lacking support. I used to think in terms of passive support. The Mubarak regime had a fair amount of passive support from various elements, the growing business class that had been growing since structural readjustment or privatization began under President Sadat back in the 70s. And they're not, of course, they're not without influence. The Christians, sort of, because it was always a question of, well, things could be worse. Although things weren't great under Mubarak, things could be worse. And the broadly speaking, the middle class as well, who were kind of disgruntled with the way things were going, but things could be worse and so forth and so on. Then the main opposition group were the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course, another Islamists further on the right that were harder to gauge. So that is the array of forces, including the organized political forces that now have come to the fore in this post-revolutionary democracy. The people who spearheaded the Tahrir revolution of January 25th were not well organized. I mean, they were good. They organized the original demonstrations quite well and quite effectively. And they knew how to use new social media and get the publicity and so forth, and to undermine this old autocracy. But when it came to electoral organizing, they were at a disadvantage. They were starting from scratch, and I think in many cases they didn't have the skills or temperament to do that. So one of the interesting things that was going on post January 25th is that when, for example, the interim constitution was put to the voters in March of 2011. Among other things, what it did was it mandated a fairly quick movement toward elections and the creation of an elected civilian government, which is what has happened now. But some of the revolutionaries actually opposed that. And the largest anti-constitutional vote in March 2011 was in Cairo in Alexandria, where you have the largest concentrations, one would assume, of liberal opinion, because they said, well, this doesn't give us a chance to organize. This, in a sense, gives the advantage to the Muslim Brotherhood, and retrospectively now we can say also to the remnants of the old National Democratic Party. I mean, in other words, this was not a French or Bolshevik-style revolution where the old regime and their supporters were taken out and shot. They're still there, and they're still voting, you know, and there's a handful of people so far who've been put on trial and convicted. So Shafiq's strength, among other things, came from the still existing networks of patronage and political, and also there's political experience in the NDP. Even though it was a government party and it was more of a patronage network than a party, they did have electioneering experience and getting out the vote experience, which apparently they were able to use effectively in these fairly free elections. So the pro-democracy, anti-dictatorship revolutionaries found themselves in the curious position of saying, we don't want to move too quickly toward an electoral democracy because that would put us at a disadvantage. And it's a hard, I mean, I would have a hard time supporting that that argument because, you know, what are you going to do? Say, well, let's wait until we have enough organization or somehow we can undermine the other guys. Yeah. That's not the way it works. Mm-hmm. It's possible that the best way to undermine the electoral popularity of the Freedom and Justice Party is to let them rule for 4 years and coming in really dire economic circumstances, partly as a consequence of the revolution and, mm-hmm. and the failures of the old regime. And if they don't perform well, maybe the bums will be thrown out and somebody else will be given a chance in 4 years. So the crucial thing is that and I did want to address that this other thing as well, that there have been some important changes, I think, in the political system that are going to be hard to change back that do seem to ensure that there will be continuing elections.
Right. Well, we can do that. Let me just very quickly, for anybody who might have tuned in, I should introduce again our guest, Ken Cuno. He's professor of history here at University of Illinois, is talking with us about Egyptian politics, as he has done a number of times before on the show. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. There also is possibility of email if you want to send along your question or comment that way. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, go ahead then and talk a little bit about what the important changes that have taken place that would suggest that their progress has been made and, in fact, that we won't go back. They'll continue mm-hmm. to go forward.
Okay. Well, I'm talking about a shift, I guess I could say, in the political culture of the country, which is actually long term. Mm-hmm. In fact, the legal changes that have been made in the interim constitution reflect, I think, this long-term shift in the political culture and the desire for nailing down democratic guarantees. Because the old constitution that was suspended after the revolution contained all of the normal guarantees of civil liberties that most constitutions should have, but they were suspended most of the time under the emergency laws. The interim constitution addresses some of the things that people thought was wrong with the old system. For example, it limits the president to 2 4-year terms. Prior to that, under Mubarak, the president served a 5-year term and could be reelected as many times as he could rig the elections. And Mubarak was at the end of his fifth term when he was run out of power. So now presidents are limited to 2 4-year terms. So if you know, worst case scenario, if you're an anti-Islamist, Morsi has 8 years and then out. The other thing is that the interim constitution, beyond the previous kinds of guarantees of civil liberties, I noticed it guarantees the freedom to peacefully assemble, which actually was not there in constitutional law nor in statute law before 2011. One could be accused of forming an illegal organization if more than five people met. And my friends and I used to joke about this all the time when we would get together in a cafe and start to have a political discussion, and somebody would look around and sort of theatrically count us and say, "Oh, you know, there's six people here. We're you know, in violation of the law because we formed an illegal organization." Mm-hmm. The right to form civil societies, as it was translated into English, is another thing guaranteed. And again, I think that simply refers to the right to form organizations to petition the government redress, as we would put it. And again, that's contrary to that old law that prohibited people from forming private voluntary organizations without you had to be approved by one of the ministries to actually have an organization that could, for example, have letterhead and publish a magazine and collect dues or something like that. So these are very important freedoms that have been enshrined. The military council has not, so far as I know, I think they have not formally suspended the old emergency law, which allows detention without trial and stuff like that. So people, some mm-hmm. people are still under detention. But in a sense, they've sort of not been exercising it, progressively less and less exercising it, I guess is what you can say. And regardless of who is elected, I think even if Shafiq is elected, he'll be under enormous pressure to cancel the emergency law that had been in place pretty much constantly since Mubarak became president, and which allowed the suspension of the normal civil liberties. So that's going to be an important thing to watch for, and it's an important symbolic measure. The presidential nominating system has been opened up too, and again, it's French style, so it's unfamiliar to us. But there are different options. Endorsement by 30 elected members of parliament could get you nominated on the ballot, or having 30,000 voter signatures spread across a sufficient geographic area. Or you could be nominated by any political party that has one member of parliament. So in other words, that really opens up the presidential nominating process, where as it used to be before 2005, it used to be that the parliament nominated a single presidential candidate who was then voted on in a referendum, and that, of course, was the candidate of the National Democratic Party that had two-thirds of parliament mm-hmm. in every election.
One of the things we're coming down to about 5-6 minutes, and sort of aside from politics, although I suppose this isn't really aside from politics, no matter who is elected president, they're going to come into office with tremendous challenges to face. Mm-hmm. The economy of the country is not in good shape. Some of the things I have read suggest that there are some people are talking about the possibility of devaluation of the currency, which would drive up prices, and that was something that people were already very unhappy about and helped to energize the movement to get rid of the old government. What sort of problems will this new government, whoever the president is, have to deal with?
Yeah, primarily domestic issues having to do with the quality of life. I mean, the economy has taken a hit because of this. In particular, the area of tourism, and tourism is one of the four top earners of foreign currency and national income. So if they can get through these elections peacefully without major problems, as they've done so far, and if the new government and the military can make nice to each other and put on a benign face, then the tourists will come back, because the stuff to see is so wonderful. It only takes about a year for people to start coming back. Mm-hmm. And the high rollers are the Americans, among others, who are the big scaredy cats. The Arab tourists come anyway. So that's one thing. But other quality of life issues have to do with the neoliberal policies I mentioned of the Mubarak government, which had been more or less dictated to them by the Americans and the Europeans, which is, you know, pay your debts off, develop a export-oriented economy in order to pay off your debts. And that means holding down, trimming the public sector, privatizing, holding down wages, and so all the sorts of things that the average person suffers from. And also the subsidies from the Nasser era, there have been subsidies of basic commodities, which were originally put in place to for a good purpose, you know, to help the little person. So subsidies on basic commodities like rice and flour, gasoline, Buddha gas, or which is cooking gas, butane gas, and so forth. There's been tremendous pressure on the government over the past decades by the IMF and World Bank to reduce these subsidies, which have been reduced, and actually to cancel them altogether. Well, the more they're reduced, the greater number of people fall below the poverty line, and it's already at about 20%. There, and there's another 20% who are sitting right on top of it. But there are ways to handle, to deal with these issues, I think, including the crucial issue of getting adequate credit from these Western agencies without punishing the average Egyptian more economically. For one thing, a popularly elected government can stand up to the Western financial institutions more effectively than a dictatorship that is dependent upon Western aid. Mm-hmm. I would think they could say, like, as the French are doing now, as the Greeks are trying to do, to say, like, okay, you just can't push us beyond a certain point. You've got to work with us to get through this. With the subsidies, for example, economists for years have been talking about a kind of a shifting to smart subsidies, which would be basically means testing, means tied subsidies, so that if your income is below a certain level, you qualify for it, and if not, not. But the system now is that Sawiris, one of the millionaires of Egypt, can get his subsidized gasoline just as well as his driver. And that's not a system that's fair. So they could work to trim the cost of that and make it more targeted to the sectors of the population that actually need it. Education is another area where they can make improvements, which would pay off in the future, if not immediately. But although education is mandatory, legally mandatory, K through 12, they have not, since the 1952 revolution, they have not built enough schools to accommodate the population of school-age kids. So there has been a persistence of adult illiteracy, so that could also be addressed, which would pay off in the long run, maybe not in the short run, but in the short run at least it would give, I guess, more a perception of fairness, because they've expanded the university system at the top end to placate the middle class while not expanding proportionately the K through 12 base. The quality of education is very poor. Teachers are incredibly underpaid. The curriculum is terrible. So there's a lot of work that can be done there as well. Basically, for 60 years, it hasn't been a responsive government. It used to be that in the poorer districts of Cairo, for example, to get the ancient sewer lines repaired, which were leaking, the most effective way was to riot, because this was done off and on, because once the sewage got up to your knees, then even a conservative person would go out and riot, because it was no good appealing to your member of parliament, because the guy was there for the payoff from the regime, not to represent the district, right? So now things will be different. If people want to keep their seats, they have to deliver to the voters. So we might see it'll be messy, but we might see some really serious politicking going on in the future.
We are going to have to stop there. We'll continue to watch. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being here so many times on the show and talking with us. Ken Cunha, he's professor of history here at the University of Illinois.